No Grand Story, What's the Point of It All? Was presented by Tim McIntosh with a response by Jack Crabtree on October 20th, 2007 at the 2007 Oktoberfest entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Thanks, Terry. We're really delighted to have our next youthful presenter. Yes. Tim McIntosh is from Georgia, from Atlanta area. We met Tim through Casey Pilcher and some of our interactions and collaborations with the Imago Dei Church in Portland last year. As it turned out, we were the beneficiaries of having him with us for the Summer Institute this summer, in which he was the guest artist. Tim is a playwright, he's a writer, he's an actor. He teaches comparative religion to high school students in the greater Atlanta area. And he's also able to make something of a living with his hands building things. So it's a real pleasure and delight to have Tim with us. And when Tim finishes his little bit, Jack is going to interact with him a little bit for a few minutes. So please welcome Tim.
Yes. All right. My name is, as Wes said, Tim McIntosh. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. Georgia is a state kind of near the Atlantic Ocean. It's a little below Tennessee, for those of you unfamiliar with the South. The subject is the death of the grand story, and just the sound of it is a huge topic. So I've tried to organize my talk by talking about my dad, growing up in Kentucky, which is a state just north of Tennessee, and kind of comparing his growing up experience with my growing up experience. And then we will launch kind of broadly into, I think, like the big subject that everybody is talking about. If you had to organize it under one subject, I would say it's this subject. The big story has died. And of course, maybe I'm just saying that because it's my topic, but I really believe that also, so it's convenient that I'm delivering, that Wes asked me to deliver this talk. That is a picture of my dad. He's a cute young guy. My dad grew up in London, Kentucky, a small town. My dad prayed to start the day in his public school. He said the Pledge of Allegiance. He treated his neighbors with dignity and respect, not because his mom and dad told him to, but because everybody expected that you would do that. He did not cheat on tests. He tucked in his shirt. If he did something wrong over at a neighbor's house, his neighbor's parents would correct him. Don't do that. Just quickly jumping ahead, I can never remember a neighbor's mom telling me, you ought not do that. I can never remember that. After dinner, neighborhood folks would porch sit with others. They would sometimes gossip around about a local fella who had gone wrong, who wasn't living right. Maybe he was a drinker, or he slept late, or he didn't go to church. And usually the gossip would conclude with something like, there are certain things that people just shouldn't do, or there are certain things that just aren't right. Conversely, people who did right were praised on the porch. He's done good for himself. She's a good girl. He's a good boy. Dad left Kentucky for the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, in 1963. That is my dad left, back row left of center, number 32. He had a basketball scholarship, sunny California, met a tri-delt named Cheryl, who's now my mom. My dad and his roommate... My dad's roommate was a guy named Kenny Washington. They were the first Division I, this is 1963, first Division I basketball player's black and white roommates. That's so shocking to me. 1963. His coach is a man named John Wooden. And if any of you guys know anything about basketball, you know the name John Wooden, widely accepted as the greatest college basketball coach in history. I'm bragging a little bit on my dad. I'm doing this for a reason, though. The pyramid here is called the Pyramid of Success. John Wooden wrote this. And it's kind of like a building block way of sort of not just winning at basketball. This is the way that you live your life. Coach Wooden was not just a basketball coach, but he was a mentor to all of his boys. He was a mentor to my dad, whose father was a bum. And anyway, industriousness, loyalty, cooperation on the bottom level led to skill and poise, and ultimately at the top of the pyramid led to success. The Pyramid of Success was founded on common sense, experience, and Judeo-Christian principles, according to John Wooden. And the Pyramid of Success seemed to lead to success. My dad won two national championships with UCLA, who's who in American colleges and universities in 1966. And again, I'm saying this not to brag about my dad, though I'm very proud of him and very, very close with him. And I'm not trying to be nostalgic. I'm trying to get across that there is a unified set of values and cultural practices that my father inherited from his community, from his parents, from his schools, and now we're moving on. 1965, as my dad said, it happened in one summer. He left school in 1965 for his summer break and came back and literally thought that he had stepped onto the wrong campus. He said when he left, everyone was dressed like on the left. Remember when Jack was talking about there was kind of like a uniform almost. He said when he left in 1965 for the summer, everyone looked like this on the left. And when he came back, everyone looked like that on the right. And he said, it is not a stylistic difference that was happening. Something profound. The world was beginning now to change in a really radical way. Here are some of the things that had been brewing for a while. Again, Jack talked on this. I'm not going to linger on it too long. Nikita Khrushchev, the top middle, the Watts riots, may not be as familiar with those of you who didn't live near California in the mid-60s. Huge urban riots in the middle of Watts. Other pictures that I've got up there, Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Vietnam War, assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Kent State student shot and killed, increasing Cold War tensions, bomb shelters on campus, etc., etc., etc. I read a book by a guy named Oz Guinness called The Dust of Death. Maybe some of you guys have read it. And I remember I was sitting at my table having dinner with my folks. This is just probably a couple of years ago. And I'm reading Oz Guinness's description of all these things happening, one after the other, after the other, after the other. And I, for the first time, realized how frightening it must have been to live at that time. And my mom said, I would wake up and I wouldn't want to read the paper because I didn't want to hear what the bad news was. It was shocking. And it forced all of us to examine what we believed and to make a choice. It felt like we could, I mean, when there are nuclear arms parked 100 miles off Florida's coast, you probably start thinking about your own mortality in a way that, in fairness, I don't think that 9/11 made me think about my mortality. It made me think, oh, something big is happening, but I was not afraid that I was going to die tomorrow, maybe because I'm naive, but I don't think that most people in my generation thought 9/11, I could die tomorrow, whereas nuclear warheads off the coast of Florida probably made you think that. My mom, who read this, said it really made us sit down and examine ourselves. It made us ask, what is the point? What is going on? What do I believe? And to make a very complex story very simple, it seemed like my parents' generation faced a fork in the road. And the fork in the road was stick with inherited cultural values that have not really been, that are quasi-Christian, but not really Christian. Stick with those and try to live them authentically in a more fully Christian way by trying to understand
the book, by going to Bible study and trying to figure out what we really believe. And the other choice was reject these inherited values. Look where they have led us. Nuclear war, racism, urban poverty, etc., 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 etc. And so there was a choice to be made. Again, I'm making things really simple. A choice to be made. And so my parents ended up becoming Christians on UCLA's campus. They would go to Campus Crusade for Christ meetings. They would organize Bible studies. My dad and mom eventually moved to Dallas, Texas, went to seminary, and moved to Atlanta, where I was born. The thing that I want to emphasize is that both sides in this choice had shared values that were either recognized as bogus or something not really fully lived or something that needed to be more fully inhabited, but they had shared values. I think that's the thing that I'm trying to get across. Part two is my father's son. That's me on campus at Little Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee. I'm glad that the picture's so far away so you can't see how big my hair was, which is the kind of the style back then. My dad, as I said, became a pastor. Growing up as his son, I was taught the Bible. I was taught that the Bible was the truth for all humanity, not just for us. That the message was the truth for all humanity. I was taught that God's expectations were absolute and not subject to revision. I was taught to say yes, ma'am, and no, sir, as signs of respect for my elders. I attended private Christian school until I was in eighth grade, best public school in the public high school in the state, and then I went to small Christian college in the foothill of Tennessee's Bryan College. And then one afternoon, Dr. Ruth Conser came into my class. I think it was either my sophomore or my junior year. And this is when I realized that something was afoot. Background about Dr. Conser. She was about 65 years old. She taught literature. I adored her. I felt the way I felt about her. I get the same sense that Gutenberg students feel about their tutors. She had tremendous moral authority with me because she loved her students, did not preach at her students. Her life was authentic in a way that I just really deeply trusted her. She'd been a welder. She had written for a newspaper. She wore a wedding band, though she had never gotten married, which caused all sorts of gossip, you know. What happened to her? Anyway, she comes into my class one day, and again, the background is I trust and love this woman. I remember she sits down. There are about 8 of us in class, and she sits down like this. She's wearing a polyester jumpsuit because she did not care what we thought of her. She sits down like this, and I think I'm not exaggerating to say that she glared at us for about 5 minutes. It seemed like 5 minutes. 5 minutes of sort of deathly silence. And I was sitting there going, what have we done wrong? Something as terrible is about to happen. Until finally, she kind of, you know, sets her glasses up and she says, you all are just a bunch of existentialists. And I thought, I don't know what that is or what that means, but I know that I am guilty of it. And looking back on it now, I think if the word postmodern had been a popular word, then that's the word that she would have used. Because what she meant was, you are apathetic. You are cynical. You don't care about anything but your own experience. That's what, you know, what's the matter with you? And again, if it had been just like a teacher that I didn't really respect, because there most of them I didn't, I would have just been like, get a grip, you know, whatever. Whatever. But with Dr. Conser, it was like ice water started flowing through my veins and I had to listen. And so for me, I started trying to figure out what she meant by this. Next page. I did not know what she meant, but I started kind of trying. I started reading books for the. It had turned off. I wonder if am I moving around too much? We're doing good on time. Closing the American Mind, really popular late, I think it was written in 88. My dad gave it to me, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it. It's a pretty dense book, especially for someone who had not read anything. Shortly after I got this book, I started reading Francis Schaeffer's book. Both Francis Schaeffer's view of kind of like how the situation came to be and Alan Bloom's description of how the situation came to be was something like this triangle you see on the left. Bad ideas begin in kind of like the elite realm of culture, and
all right, I'll try to stay closer.
From philosophy to art to music to theology to popular culture, it's kind of like a top-down sort of bad ideas slowly trickle down into culture. This may be actually what happened. It may not be what happened. Regardless of how it happened, I think that the biggest misunderstanding between my father and me has been that he thinks that I am the way that I am because bad ideas somehow trickled down into me. But it doesn't explain me that well. I mean, I heard Augustine and St. Paul 100 times for every time I heard Derrida or one of the existentialists. I saw the Andy Griffith Show and Leave It to Beaver 1,000 times before I saw anything or heard anything that resembled kind of like, you know, a postmodern sort of message in a movie or in a song. And so I began to get skeptical that this kind of model could really explain who I was and the way that I felt about things. So I think that what happened, the biggest difference between my father and I, is that the grand story between his time in college and the time that I was in college, the big story died. And there are corroborating evidence for this. I'm going to cite three kind of things, three authors. The first is Duke theologian Stanley Hauerwas. Some of you have maybe read him. Says, Christendom ended on a Sunday evening in 1963 in Greenville, South Carolina. And you're like, what? You know, but it's hyperbole. But his point is this. On that day, movie theaters started showing movies on Sunday night. And it was the time that that society was no longer going to help the Christian church. It was no longer going to kind of like be a steward of the Christian church. Stanley Hauerwas and his friends snuck out back of the church that day and went to the movies. And that's the day that Christendom ended. By Christendom, he does not mean we were a Christian nation and now we are a secular. It doesn't mean anything like that. He means that there was enough residual sort of Christianity in the culture that people played by its rules. But it ended in 1963. Other people date the end of the grand story more as like an end of modernism. Those two things, that they go together, is kind of telling. Anyway, I won't diverge. 1972 is when another group of people date the end of this grand story. It is the destruction. I missed a slide. The first one, end of Christendom, bottom left. End of modernity, 1971. The destruction of the Pruitt-Igoe housing development in St. Louis. Built only 20 years earlier, the apartments were crisp, clean, critically praised, followed all the latest and greatest techniques of kind of architectural fashion. And they were totally unlivable. There was something anti-human, to kind of capitalize on what cases, there's something anti-human about them. They were mathematical, rationally built, critically praised. People hated it, hated living there. Destroyed in 71, maybe 72. Others mark the change as kind of beginning in 1979, or symbolically being marked in 1979 with the publishing of Jean-François Lyotard's book, The Postmodern Condition. That's Lyotard, upper right-hand corner. We may not be able to pinpoint an exact symbolic date, but nonetheless, it is a reality that the grand story that my father grew up in, his grandfather,
had died sometime between his college years and my college years. I'm going to highlight three sociological changes, and I'm going to breeze through them because they've been talked about so well by the other panelists. I'm going to talk about three sociological changes that have helped bring about the end of the story and also help reinforce that there is no grand story. So I'm going to focus on sociological changes rather than philosophical changes that have come down. Does that make sense where I'm kind of going there? One is the data avalanche. Everyone has talked about this. The amount of information that is being given to us is absolutely overwhelming. I have heard, for whatever it's worth, that the average plugged-in American consumes more information in 1 month than an average 18th century American did in a lifetime. It is not just the amount of information, but how we value it and attribute meaning to that information. Data is constantly being thrown at us without a broader interpretive framework to make sense of things. Just as a thought experiment, my aunt finally did it. You hear that and you're, what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. It's a data blip. My aunt finally did it. She recovered from foot surgery and she ran her first marathon. Oh, your aunt did. Okay, that makes sense to me. So without a broader kind of narrative framework for making sense of all this data, all it is data. All it is just bits and bits and bits and bits and bits. What does it all mean? It's almost impossible to tell. Second thing, emotional skepticism. That little question there, are your parents still together? I asked my friend Lee, who's 55 years old, we were kind of becoming friends, and I said, are your parents still together? And he said, what? And I said, you know, are they still married? And he's like, yeah, of course they're still married. And it just struck him later on, he's like, nobody my age would ask me that question. Yeah, of course my parents are still married. It's like one of the, you know, it's just a question that we ask, my friends ask each other. Between the 1950s and the 1980s, the ratio of divorced to married people increased fourfold. In that same time, births to unmarried women grew from 5% in the 1950s to 32% in the 1990s. Today, one of every three children in the U.S. is born out of wedlock. I am not trying to heap criticism on those of you who have gone through a divorce or those of you who are trying to raise kids as single parents. I'm not trying. You have a hard job, and I'm not trying to make your job easier with kind of like adding the burden of criticism to you. But to just overlook the fact that this is a profound sociological change, has a profound effect on the way that younger people trust and navigate their world. To ignore it would just be sort of lying. In short, I think my generation has been wired, hardwired, psychologically wired against trust. Very suspicious, for very good reasons. Third, hyperpluralism, both in belief and in demographics. Philosopher Charles Taylor said, we live in webs of interlocution, webs of conversation. Our dialogue partners help form our moral beliefs. If our community is broken and fragmented, our experience will be also. If our community is broken and fragmented, our experience will be also. My dad's porch-sitting neighbors shared values, beliefs, and expectations. There was a unified sense of experience. They were largely white, Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Their beliefs were largely, to use Hauerwas's phrase, the beliefs of Christendom. Now, about 3 miles from where I live in Atlanta, there's a 7-mile stretch of road called Buford Highway that is the most ethnically diverse populace in the entire world. Buford Highway. If you drive down the road, you can watch the street signs change languages as you drive. And you drive and you're like, this is a neighborhood, and I have no idea the way that they think about their life, the way that they, what things they value. I have no idea what their religious background is, if any. Each neighborhood has its own language, customs, and latent beliefs. Our society is not merely ethnically diverse, but wildly pluralistic about ideas. Wildly pluralistic about ideas. You don't even have to cross the road on your in your neighborhood now to hear five different viewpoints. They could be political liberals, fundamentalist Christians, Air Force retirees, Ukrainian immigrants, Mormons, Wiccans, Seahawks fans, old school Marxists, neoconservatives, Muslims, Reformed Jews, paleoconservatives, lapsed Catholics, easygoing hippies. My dad wouldn't know what any of those things were when he was 13 years old. He wouldn't know any of that. From a very early age, I was plagued by this thought that if I were born in Cairo, I would be a Muslim. If I were born in New Delhi, I would be a Hindu. If I were born in Eugene, I would be a free-loving hippie. And this, so early on, this sort of like sort of sense that what I believe is not what other people believe, and I don't know how to understand exactly what they believe, is the equipment that was given to me at maybe age 11. I don't think that I was alone in this. Think about like a student going to the University of Georgia or a student going to the U of O. They go to different classes. Latin American political science teacher is a Marxist. British literature professor is a deconstructionist. Psychology 101 professor is a Lacanian. Introduction to philosophy professor is a Heideggerian. Biology professor is a materialist. Sociology professor is a neo-functionalist. None of these professors talk. There is no kind of broader interpretive framework that they're all operating under. There are so few similarities between them. You can understand why someone going to university would walk in and just start compartmentalizing what they believe to suit the proclivities of their particular professor. If I want to get a good grade, got to be a Lacanian in psychology class. Want to get a good grade in philosophy, got to be a Heideggerian today. And so you move in these different realms, and you learn to compartmentalize your beliefs, and not really compartmentalize your beliefs, but just give them what they want to get through. That's what you got to do. You want to get an A in philosophy, you got to be a Heideggerian for an hour and a half a day. Hyperpluralism does not stop outside of church walls, and I'm thinking specifically about Protestants. So just a real quick list of churches, you know, all within a one-mile radius of where I live. Methodist, Baptist, Nazarene, House Church, Mainline Presbyterian, Evangelical Presbyterian, Pentecostal, Lutheran, Reformed, Catholic, Episcopalian, Non-Denominational, Health and Wealth, Charismatic. Each with their slightly unique telling on what the gospel is. Each with their own slightly unique language. Each with their own subtly understood customs. And so, again, you walk into this church and you're like, okay, I've got to figure out what the customs are here, what language I'm allowed to use, what their own subtle interpretation of the gospel is, got to figure it out. The question of which is true seems impossible to ask. Impossible to ask. It was Walter who was talking about several friends of his that had converted to Catholicism. Right, Walter? Where are you, Walter? I've had a real similar experience. My friends haven't converted to Catholicism. They converted Eastern Orthodoxy. I've had a dozen. These are not... these are highly intelligent people who are tired. As my brother-in-law who converted said, I got so tired of sitting in a Protestant pew and listening to the pastor and not being able to turn off my brain. And do not misunderstand him to think that he's saying, I want a religious experience in which I don't have to think or scrutinize my beliefs. That is not what he's saying. What he's saying is, I want to trust that what I am hearing is 2,000 years old. That it is the truth of what Christians have believed and believed for a long time. I don't want something special. I want what Christians have believed. And I want to be able to trust it. And so he knew that an Eastern Orthodox priest, if he started preaching something crazy, is out. He's out the next week. But if he went to a Protestant church, the guy's got, you know, kind of like a complex about trying to get more people into his church. He can't really trust it. Is it really the gospel? I'm going to close with a quote. I almost committed this to memory. If meaning is contextual, writes Pulitzer Prize winner Annie Dillard, and it is contextual, then the collapse of order to Western society and its inherited values cannot be overstressed. When we lost our context, we lost our meaning. We became, all of us in the West, more impoverished and in one sense more ignorant than pygmies. Pygmies, an isolated people group with a millennium-old mythology, knew at least one great thing, why they are here. Very briefly, and then I'll wrap up. I tried, because I love my dad so much and because I respect him so much. I mean, pastor's kids, you probably know, are hypersensitive about the hypocrisy in their own home. And my dad was not a hypocrite. I trusted him very deeply. And I tried so hard to do it his way. I mean, I tried it with everything I could. I tried his epistemology mainly, fully. And I became a Christian on the day his epistemology was finally killed in me, if that makes sense. The day it was killed was the day I understood who Christ was. Which is not to say that my dad knows Christ just as well as I do. It's something we share, and we share very deeply. But the method to which we tried to understand Christ is radically different. But we ended up in the same place. So I have a hard time talking to my dad about sort of like methodological things or epistemological things. Very easy time talking to him about the wisdom of the Old Testament and how I ought to try to handle a kind of like a moral dilemma in my life, or how I ought to treat someone who I don't really understand. We have so much in common, and there's so much I need from him that I've got to get from him. But it is so hard for us to talk about methodology, and I think that's kind of like a little microcosm of what this conference is about. So now, I only went 2 minutes over time, and I'm done. Jack.
I had a bunch of other questions, but that was way too intriguing to resist. Okay, so give me some examples.
Examples of
the arguments that you would have with your dad over methodology and epistemology.
This is not the best example. Oh, no. You had to ask that question. This is not a direct answer. I remember my dad's friend telling him, and I was probably 14 when this happened, he said to my dad, "Now, we know that America is the most advanced civilization in human history, but blah, 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 blah." And I thought, in a very rudimentary way when I was 14 years old, if that can be a truth statement, wouldn't all societies have to agree axiomatically on certain things, that certain things would be the mark of high civilization? All cultures obviously don't agree on those axiomatic things. That statement is a nonsense statement. It's not like necessarily a false statement. It's just a nonsense statement. And again, I was 14 years old, but the fact that my dad and his friend, who are not colonialists, would say that and accept it as just a matter of course, I just thought, I don't understand that at all. Is that a decent example?
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. Okay, let me shift gears a little bit. And I don't know whether you want to speak. Well, actually, maybe this will help first. If you could, you've gone a part way toward explaining that already. But so where do you sit now? I mean, were you not a believer for a while? Did you consider yourself not a believer for a while and then come back? And if... And I have a follow-up question of that.
Okay. When I was in college, I would have said, in the right company, I'm an atheist. At my house, never would have said that. In my church, never would have said that. Only to certain friends would I have said that. And deep down, that's what I was. I mean, I was an atheist. I became a theist when I realized how much I wanted to chop people's heads off. But I was not a Christian at that point. But at least was, I had this sort of sense that, like, if I am the moral arbitrator of the universe, this would be an awful place to live. Even if I were king, I don't think, I wouldn't want that sort of world. There seems like there has to be something outside of me, some sort of moral world outside of my own making. And that's when I became a theist, but not until I didn't become a Christian later until I was at Le Brie. That's kind of the moment that it happened.
Okay. So when you were decidedly not a Christian, would you have described yourself as without a meta-narrative or simply not without the Christian meta-narrative? What I'm getting at is that we've had intimations at various times that the postmodern generation has even abandoned the very notion of a meta-narrative.
Yeah.
Was that your experience, or was it simply that you had rejected the Christian meta-narrative?
I had rejected the Christian meta-narrative, and that was, I knew it very well. I rejected it, but I didn't think that it existed as a meta-narrative. I thought that it only existed for people who made that choice on a somewhat arbitrary level, and they didn't really seem to be abiding by it. So it had become very privatized, and I was like, that's a suitcase I'm just not going to carry anymore. I'm not saying that very clearly. Does it make sense?
Yeah. So perhaps what you're saying is without perhaps reaching the philosophical conclusion that there is no such thing as a grand story, it was sociologically your experience.
Absolutely,
that everything was only a private story.
Right.
And you had to decide to carry the suitcase before it was yours.
Exactly. So it wouldn't have been, I reject that. It would have been, I reject that that you're carrying.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, interesting. What do you have any reaction or any perspective on the philosophical perspective that there is no such thing as a grand story and that it makes no sense even to see a story as universally in judgment of all stories?
I strongly believe that now, but I only believe that because I believe in Christ first, and there's no way I could have come to that conclusion without being inculcated into a spiritual reality. But again, I think the way that my dad and I would describe that broader meta-narrative, well, I'll just leave it at that. I do believe that there is a meta-narrative. The way that it's approached, the way that I would understand it is probably very different from the way that my dad understands it. Boy, I'm being smushy. Anyway.
That's the way you understand it. So it doesn't sound like this is really ever your experience, so this may not be a fair question, but one of the questions that's been haunting me is, I cannot imagine living a life without the grand story to make sense out of my life. And so if there are any friends that you have, if you have any way of relating to the idea of what would it even look like to not have a meta-narrative?
I mean,
how do you get through the day? From the time you wake up to the evening, if you don't have any guidance from a story about why you're here and why anybody's here and what this is all about, how do you do that? How does one do that? Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, I think you do what you have to do. I mean, it's, you get up, you need food to eat, go to work. Boss wants you to work this certain way. Okay, I'll do it the way that you want to do it. Teacher wants you to do it this way. I'll do it the way that you want to do it. There's no sense of, I'm going to serve my boss because it is right and good to be a loving person that cares for this other person's needs, this other person's trying to run a business. And so I'm going to do the best that I can to serve and love this person. She's like, I just got to do what I got to do.
So you're always dancing to the tune of whoever's...
Exactly.
I was struck by your example. I remember my son going to college, and he wrote a paper, and he asked me to read it and edit it. And And I was completely shocked
mm.
because I didn't know he believed in any of that stuff. And I said, Tyler, I didn't know you believed this stuff. Oh, I don't. That's yeah. just what they want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never would have dreamt in my day and age, I never would have dreamt of writing a paper in college that I couldn't somehow own and make my own. But I realized, as we talked, I realized he didn't dare risk doing that.
Right. And to expand on that a little bit more, there is no, to take on your professor is to only subject yourself to public ridicule. Mm-hmm. There is no, there are no benefits that would come mm-hmm. for standing for, you know, what you believed, because there is, the public realm is so vicious. Mm-hmm. And all you're doing is just opening yourself up to say, throw darts at me. With no possible good outcome, no perceived possible good outcome.
Yeah, that's a striking difference in our experience. Can you elaborate at all then on what happened that brought about your return to the Christian story? It wasn't the way your father would have got there.
No, I'll try to make it real short. I started reading any epistemology I could get my hands on. I mean, anything. I read Kant. I just read all the daddies. And I'm going up the hill away from, I'm in Swiss Liberty, I'm going up the hill. A little more background. I was resolved that when I got to Liberty, 26 years old, I'm going to figure this question out, put it to bed. Got to solve it. It's driving me crazy. And I think I'm a little bit sort of weird in that. I'm different from my friends in that extent. I don't think they feel that kind of compulsion. I'm going up the hill from having heard another set of lectures on epistemology, and I put my hand on the post, and I look down at my hand on the post, and I'm like, don't know that it's really there. And that seems like something, you know, an 8-year-old has sometimes when they're waking up and, you know, they have that kind of breakdown between subjectivity and objectivity or whatever. But the fact that it happened to me at 26 years old, and it was not a passing thought, it was a real psychological actuality, so much so that the only thing I knew to do was to go get drunk. And I got drunk that night. I mean, because I just needed to get out of it. And without being too public about something that's really, really deeply inside of me, I almost don't want to be profane about it, is I had this recognition that Jesus Christ was, there's no truer fact than him. Why would I try to put something underneath him to prop him up? I mean, if he says that he is the way, the truth, and the life, what could be more true or more real than that? And so everything then moved out from there. I'll stop there.
Okay. Just one last question. I don't know if you are representative of this group, but I sometimes get the impression from people who call themselves postmodern Christians that they actually want to reconceive of Christianity such that Christianity is not a grand story, is not a meta-narrative. Is that true? Am I reading that culture right?
I think you are reading that culture right. There is a desire to say, we will play our game, you will play your game. Since there's no way to adjudicate between your game and our game, let's just play the game. You do it your way, and I'll do it our way. And so I'm fundamentally against that. But I strongly recognize the real sense of hopelessness in adjudicating between these conflicting beliefs. I'm so sympathetic with that. 100% sympathetic with that, but that just can't be a resting place. I don't think that Christ should content to just sit there and say, yeah, okay, play your game around me.
Okay, I think we're about out of time. So.